This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Among guitar players and critics, it is said there isn't a stronger, more decisive, more intelligent right arm in the world than the one that belonged to Doc Watson. Doc lived nearly all his life in the place where he was born, Deep Gap, North Carolina. He learned to play a catskin banjo and use a crosscut saw when he was a kid growing up with his seven brothers and sisters on his parents' farm. And it was the acoustic guitar that would change his life and the sound of American music. Doc's virtuosity brought the guitar out from behind the banjo and the fiddle in bluegrass, and his knowledge and passion of mountain and folk music brought it to the coffee houses of New York City and the auditoriums of America's leading universities. Doc Watson died last month at the age of 89, and today we'd like to properly celebrate his life, his music, and his legacy. We're going to start that conversation with Robert Cantwell. He's the Townsend Ludington Professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill and author of the book When We Were Good, The Folk Revival. Bob, welcome to the State of Things.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So give us the overview. Why was Doc Watson so important?
Well, you've said part of it. His extraordinary guitar playing influenced all the young folks who were entering the folk revival in the early 1960s, and spread far and wide to the extent that if you hear a bluegrass band these days, very likely you'll hear, along with the banjo, fiddle, mandolin, dobro solos, you will hear a guitar solo, a flat-picking technique that Doc really introduced into the performance stream of traditional music. There had been guitarists before him that played with a straight pick, as Doc called it, a flat pick. But his strength and accuracy and economy and sheer power of imagination made his playing distinctive. I suspect there's not a person in this room who hasn't tried to play a Doc Watson lick.
We have a few musicians in this room. We're going to hear from in just a little bit. Tell us about that folk revival, that thing that made it possible for Doc to come to the attention of the rest of the nation.
Right. That's a long story, but I'll try to make it short if I can. The folk revival was a kind of explosion of interest in folk music, so-called, between about 1958, when the Kingston Trio came on the radio airwaves with an old North Carolina mountain ballad, Tom Dooley. And I suppose the folk revival ended perhaps with the British invasion around 1964, when the Beatles and the Animals and all the others were making their place in American music. For Doc, one of the most interesting, and I think obviously influential moments came when a prominent folklorist named Ralph Rinzler, sort of an impresario and a playmaker, visited the Union Grove Fiddlers Convention in North Carolina in 1960. He was playing at that time with a bluegrass band from the North, the Greenbrier Boys, and they were cheeky enough to enter the band contest in Union Grove, and lo and behold, they won the contest. Yankees won the contest.
Oh,
yeah, it was unprecedented. It was a first.
Oh.
I guess it should be mentioned that the Greenbrier Boys were named after an exclusive mountain resort. Maybe that gave them away. But in any case, Ralph told the story that in a schoolroom at Union Grove, where some of the bands were rehearsing, he came across a little group, Clint Howard, Fred Price from Mountain City, Tennessee, and a banjo player, Jimmy Johnson, I think his name was. And they were being coached by a fellow who called himself Tom Ashley. And Ralph was interested in that because he had heard on the Folkways Anthology of American Folk Music. Maybe I should say a few words about that. This
sure.
will be a long parenthesis. historic, epoch-making anthology of folk music, the Folkways Anthology, was released in 1952 by Folkways Records. The man who created it was a visual artist, a filmmaker, avant-garde filmmaker, a collector of virtually everything he came across, Harry Smith, a beatnik, one should add. And I think he put this record collection together because he needed the money.
Well, and it's one of the pillars of this folk revival.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
One of the reasons anybody knew about this stuff and then got interested in it as a way of kind of finding an authentic America, which was kind of what
absolutely.
Was going on at that time.
It made a huge impact in the urban folk scene.
And Ashley's one of the guys who's actually now a little bit more prominent. He's gotten some reputation owing to this.
Well, he plays the house carpenter, but more importantly, the cuckoo bird, an old English in modal style on the anthology. And I think virtually every revivalist who heard the anthology tried to reproduce that. So what happened was at Union Grove, Ralph notices this old fellow. Old, he was 65.
just a kid.
Yeah, just a kid, right. Tom Ashley, and said, well, you know, there's an Ashley that played on the old Folkways anthology. Would that be you, Clarence Ashley? And there are many stories surrounding this, but in effect, yeah, it was Tom Ashley, Tom Clarence Ashley, Clarence Tom Ashley. So Ralph was astonished to discover that he had encountered a man who he thought was lost in the mists of time. Here was Tom Ashley. And, it's a long story, but what happened was a few months later, Ralph had arranged to make a recording of Ashley's group. The ultimate idea was to bring them up to the North to play for revivalist audiences. And in the process of making that recording, Clarence introduced him to his, not a neighbor really, lived over the mountain in North Carolina, Doc Watson. He was in his late 30s at that point, a guitar player. And Doc had been playing at that point with a country western band, playing a Les Paul electric guitar, but he had learned to play fiddle tunes and fiddle breaks using a flat pick.
Interesting that he was playing electric guitar at that time.
Absolutely.
But go ahead, yeah.
Well, and when they arranged to make the recording up in Southwest Virginia, Doc at first refused to play acoustic guitar. He thought of himself as an electric guitar player, and he felt that was going to be the key to popularity. And so there was a little bit of a riff there, and Ralph thought that his experiment was going to fail. And then Doc changed his mind. There's a story about Doc rapping on the back window of a pickup truck where Ralph was riding, playing the banjo, and the truck stopped. Doc got out, said, "Let me see that banjo, son." And he played, guess what, Tom Dooley. He played the version of Tom Dooley that he knew from Deep Gap, an older version.
Eventually recorded and did the acoustic. I mean, it's a great story because the guy from the big city comes down and says, put that fancy electric thing away.
Absolutely.
We want to hear your authentic mountain sound. He says, no, that's not where the future is. Yeah. Kind of a great tension there.
Right.
But he does come to the attention of all of us. And at this point, I want to introduce Kent Gustafson to the program. Kent is the author of a biography of Doc Watson, Was Blind But Now I See, the biography of music legend Doc Watson. Kent Gustafson, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about that, about the impact that Doc had, because he does, in effect, become a bridge between North and South once he comes to our attention, right?
Yeah, and it all really started with that visit from Ralph Rinsler, which was beautifully described there. And Jack Johnson, the banjo player who was playing with the duo there at the Fiddle Festival, Rinsler actually, he was part of this whole mess in the pickup truck. Rinsler had gone up to get him. That's how much he disliked Doc Watson's electric guitar. He was surprised to see him the next day. Rinsler was not too much a fan of Doc Watson's guitar playing. But what's amazing about Doc Watson is Ralph Rinsler guided him the first few years of his career into playing just traditional music, but then once Doc got some of the reins of his own career and his son came into the business, he snuck back towards popular music and a little bit back towards sort of Nashville. Doc became a wonderful bridge between northern folk music and southern versions of, you know, old Opry tunes and things.
And he also was a bridge between instruments. He's famous for having transposed fiddle tunes and making them sound just right for the guitar. We have an example here. We're going to listen to Kenny Baker on the fiddle. He's playing Black Mountain Rag, and this is the version that Doc Watson most likely would have heard, the fiddle version of Black Mountain Rag. It's So that's what Doc would have heard, and then here's what he did to it when he decided it might sound a little better on a guitar. There we go, Doc Watson, Doc and Merle, Black Mountain Rag. Bob Cantwell, why is that such an innovation?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Doc's musical imagination. It's innovative partly because of the mobility of his right hand and arm. Doc had an exceptionally mobile and strong right arm. I'm thinking of the crosscut saw to which his father introduced him. He was like so many great traditional musicians. I'm thinking also of Bill Monroe. When you have that strong arm and hand applied to a banjo or a guitar, you get a very special sound.
Tell you what, we're going to take a break right there. We're going to find out how he got that strong arm and how he got that ear full of music. Growing up in the mountains of western North Carolina, we're talking about Doc Watson today with Bob Cantwell of UNC, Kent Gustafson, who wrote the book Was Blind, Now I Can See. Bob's book is When We Were Good, The Folk Revival. And we will do that and hear from some live musicians who were had a great impact and whose careers Doc Watson was quite influential. You'll hear more of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're celebrating the life, music, and legacy of Doc Watson, native of Deep Gap, North Carolina, died last month at the age of 89. With us on the program are Robert Cantwell, a professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and Kent Gustafson, who's author of the book Was Blind, But Now I See, a biography of music legend Doc Watson. And joining us now are musicians Danny Gotham, Jim Collier, and Joe Newberry. And between and among them, we have guitars, a mandolin, a banjo, and harmonica. Gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you here.
We got a party, Frank.
We got a party. We got a party.
It's a jam session.
And a lot of good music. You know, before the break, Bob, we were talking about the impact of an ability of Doc Watson to transpose those fiddle songs and turn them into guitar pieces.
Well, you asked about the influence. It was unprecedented. No one had ever heard guitar played that way, acoustic guitar, unless it was Django Reinhardt, the gypsy guitar player, who incidentally also grew up playing a banjo and whom Doc heard as a youth on record. So it was unprecedented and novel in that sense. But I want to say that whenever Doc played, he always carried us into other musical worlds. If you listen to his licks, they're all charged with meaning. They all you can hear the the Smoky Dance Hall in San Antonio. You can hear the Canal Street, Beale Street. You can hear the Ryman Auditorium in 1956. Doc's musical imagination is always present to us when he plays. And so it isn't just a matter of simply being dazzled by virtuosity. We're carried off and we experience his musical universe through his music. And that, I think that's one reason his music stays with us and is so distinctive.
Kent, what was it that carried off Doc? What was it that got him enamored with music?
Well, as a kid, I think what's amazing that we forget to think about is that all the things that Bob mentioned there were all that Doc had in his musical world. He didn't have an iPod. He didn't have music everywhere. You know, he heard music every once in a while, and he had to seek it out, and he did. He would listen to music wherever he could, whether it be his granny on the porch or the Grand Ole Opry.
He was doing that, but it's interesting because in your book you point out that it was actually a trip down that mountain and into the big city that might have opened him up to other worlds of music.
Yep, yeah, and that's what Bob also mentioned there, that Doc had heard Django Reinhardt, he heard the Tobacco Tags, he heard all sorts of things for the first time during those 3 or 4 years. In Raleigh, at the Raleigh School for the Blind, his teachers would listen to jazz on the radio. They would go to live performances. Doc heard classical music and learned the rudiments of classical music, singing and on the piano and all sorts of things.
Learned everything but obedience, apparently. He didn't last long at that school, did he?
Yeah, he got suspended for smoking, which people that know Doc are surprised by.
Yeah, no, he didn't get those pure tones. Well, he must have quit awful early because he wouldn't sound like that if he kept it up. So let's talk about this flat picking style. Danny Gotham, you know, you teach guitar and you are sitting there with the guitar on your lap. Give us a sense of what we mean when we talk about a flat picking style. What is that?
Well, generally, flat picking just becomes it's an acoustic guitar style primarily. That's when I hear that term. And the way I teach my students, I'll just explain it to you. You really start with just a kind of like a bass strum, and then you might double it up a little bit, and then you might add some bass runs, and bass runs. Get longer. So there's a lot of that, but there's also the fiddle tune, which is really like a lot of the work that you hear flat pickers do is based on fiddle tunes and variations on the fiddle tunes. And that's pretty much it.
Well, let's listen to what it sounds like when Doc Watson does it. This is a song called Doc's Guitar. Doc's guitar, Doc Watson, who we're celebrating today in the program. That style, because it's, you know, obviously his left hand is making the melody, but there's only one tool in his right hand, that little flat pick, making all those notes in rapid succession.
Well, actually, that was him finger picking, believe me.
Yeah. He was also a fearsomely good finger picker.
And show us how that's going to sound different. So give us a sense of that and slow it down for us a little bit.
Yeah. Well,
if you can, that's hard to do.
He did it with two fingers as well. I don't know if I could do it like that. He played with two fingers. Gary Davis did too, and so did Merle Travis. I don't know how in the world he did it.
Yeah, Doc, he loved all sorts of music, as they said. And the thing is that Doc actually named his son for Merle Travis and Eddie Arnold. And so Doc making all that music with two fingers is pretty cool. And you know, it's that alternating bass going back.
Well, sometimes all that music with just one instrument, just that flat pick, got to go up and down, back and forth, and then you're transposing a fiddle tune where you've got a bow, can play several strings at once. So it's a pretty amazing sound. Ken, how did he pick up the guitar? Why was it that he was drawn to the guitar in the first place?
Well, I think the guitar has a long history, of course, but it doesn't have all that long a history in the United States. And Doc... really, he sat on a great era when the guitar came into prominence. And Doc is, to a large extent, responsible for that. People saw Doc play the acoustic and picked up a guitar. But he also sat right on a great era where microphones got better and recordings got better and the guitar could come out more because in a group full of really loud instruments like banjos and trumpets and things like that, if you don't amplify a guitar, it's going to get lost.
Jim Collier, you knew the Watson family and you have been up to Doc Watson's home now and then. Give us a sense of what that place was like when you walked in there.
Well, I've spent a lot of time with his mother and his brother Arnold and their immediate family. They lived on the original property and in the second house. The first one had fallen down. They built a second house there. And I met Doc through essentially my relationship with his family. And, you know, at one time before that, I'd made a cold call with a friend, went to his house, and he was up fixing his roof, replacing shingles. And so he put us with his daughter Nancy, and she showed us instruments and talked to us about what she was up to and talked a little bit about Doc. But then Doc finally came down and spent probably half an hour with us. But he was really intent on getting that job done, and he loved to do things like that. That was a thing that was real neat. And, you know, Arnold told me, he says, you know, if you mess with Doc, don't you let him get a hold of you, because he would absolutely, he could wring your neck. I mean, he was a strong man.
He's like, putting shingles on his house? I am fully excited, and I would lose all five fingers of my left hand.
Wait a minute. He also wired his house electrically and had it checked out.
Hold
by
it.
The
There's the red, the white, and
that's
the blue.
Okay.
You got to know that.
Yeah, well, he did.
Wow. So
he wired his entire house. I mean, the guy was amazing.
You could hear the colors.
Yeah, I was up at Wayne Henderson's shop one time, and I said, that's a nice stool. It was nicely hand-caned. And Wayne said, turn it over. And on the other side, it said, hand-caned by Arthur Watson.
Well, that's something that he would have learned at the
Moorhead
School,
because
we have several chairs in our house also. That are
Well, you know, it's one thing to cane a chair and quite another to hit a nail accurately. And I know I can't do it either. Bob, tell us a little bit about, again, the influence of this guitar, because we're talking about the folk revival, and when we think of folk, we naturally think of the guitar. What was happening in the early days of that, and where did Doc fit in his playing?
Well, I think a good place to look to would be to Greenwich Village and to someone like Bob Dylan, who I suppose embodies all of the different stages of the folk revival, including its spectacular conclusion when he brought an electric guitar to Newport. But the point is that young revivalists saw themselves as folk singers, self-accompanied on guitar. I think Kent's point is extremely well taken. It's true in bluegrass, too, that superior amplification made it possible for the guitar to come forward and make itself known. So in the process of learning the guitar, Doc's playing stood out among other players as something to be emulated. It was an acoustic sound, and it was deeply embedded, quite obviously, in mountain tradition. And that was certainly partly the influence of folklorists who had, like Ralph, who had found Doc and encouraged him to find his audience in the folk revival. I'd like to add that we don't say much about Doc's voice, but he had a wonderful, congenial, avuncular sort of voice. I would compare him to singers. Well, Eddie Arnold is one of those great influences, along with Merle Travis. To me, he sounds a lot like Gene Autry.
But it's a pure tone. He can sound a lot like, and then he is utterly unique. No, there is no recreating that sound. It's
absolutely. No.
One of the things about Doc is he was perfectly suited to be a singer. He had a barrel chest. I mean, he was strong. He was a strong man. And the other thing is, you will find no one who worked a mic, maybe except for you, Frank, better. Because he would get right up on that mic, and as you get closer to the mic, well, there's a little bit more presence. And Doc, to watch him sing, and he I guess, trained himself to the only thing between Doc and the mic was a couple of millimeters, and it made for a huge sound.
It's a huge sound, but you better be good if you're going to be that close.
Well,
because it's going to pick up, you know, the bad a lot louder and a lot clearer.
Fortunately for us, he was Doc Watson.
He was Doc Watson. Well, let's talk about his influence as well, because Doc didn't write a lot of music, but he did interpret other people's songs that ultimately became definitive. And I think probably a pretty good example of that is Jimmy Rogers' tune, My Rough and Rowdy Ways. Now, we're going to do a comparison here. Here's Jimmy Rogers doing his own song, My Rough and Rowdy Ways.
Sometimes I meet a bounder who knew me when I was a rounder. He grabs my hand and says, boy, have a drink. We go down to the pool room, get in the gang, and then soon the daylight comes before I've had a wink.
All right, there's Jimmy Rogers doing his own song, My Rough and Rowdy Ways. Doc Watson liked it an awful lot, and so he did the same song.
Sometimes I meet a bounder who knew me when I was a rounder. He grabbed my hand, he'll say, boy, have a drink. We go down to the pool room, getting a game, and then soon It's broad daylight, and I ain't had a wing.
There's Doc Watson doing Jimmy Rogers, My Rough and Rowdy Ways. Joe, what is it about, or let me ask you, Danny, what is it about that song that has made it the definitive version of that song?
Well, I think what Doc did was he would take somebody's song, somebody else that wrote the song, and make it his. And when I hear it, I know it's a Jimmy Rogers song, but the version that I like is Doc's because he made it more, I guess I just call it palatable or something. Yeah. He made it smoother. You know, for a kid growing up in upstate New York, it wasn't a hotbed of country music and bluegrass up there. So when I heard Doc, that led me to Jimmy Rogers. If I heard Jimmy Rogers first, I don't think it would have caught my ear.
That's interesting, yeah. It. I mean, the word I would use is it swings.
Yes,
When Doc does it, it swings the other way. Kind of like it's a lot of notes. Well, so what would you do? So I got three musicians in the room. Let's hear your interpretation after hearing Doc.
Years and years of ramble, drink my wine and gamble. Then one day I thought I'd settle down. I had a sweet little baby, she told me that you'd be my baby. We'd build a cottage in the old hometown. Can't forget my good old rambling days. Them old freight trains keep calling me away. I may be rough, I may be wild, I may act tough, but it's just my style. Cause I can't forget my good old rough and rowdy ways.
There we have Danny Gotham, Jim Collier, and Joe Newberry's version of Rough and Rowdy Ways. And Jim, is that the way you see it? I mean, in a way, you're drawn to the music. He draws you to music that otherwise, you know, you might not want to play.
Well, it certainly drew me to it. I remember buying the first record that I got was Doc Watson Family. And after I heard that, it was just, I couldn't get enough of it. And so I set about doing the best that I could, learning everything that I could off that record.
Doc Watson's family was awfully important to him. Merle, of course, who passed away in the 1980s, was very important. And it's his son Merle is celebrated every year at Merle Fest, a concert in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. For the past 18 years, Art Menias has been co-coordinator of Merle Fest. He recently became director of the Art Center in Carrboro, but he joins us now in the studio. Art, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here. And, you know, Merle, too, Doc was similarly important. We've had a lot of discussion on the show today about Doc and the folk revival. And when Doc's career truly took off in Doc's telling of the story was when Merle went with him, which first occurred in 1965 after Rosalie gave Merle his first banjo lessons, and they performed at the first three-day bluegrass festival with 16-year-old Merle driving them all at a high rate of speed up the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is, of course, not built for a high rate of speed. I think 40 or 45 is the fastest the parkway gets, but Merle got them up there. And when I talked to Doc in 1997 for an article, I went in with a lot of trepidation about even to broach the topic of Merle, especially at the festival interacting with Rosalie and the heavy sadness she carries to this day. But Doc launched right into talking about Merle and saying, in the dues-paying days, which was the folk revival time, if I hadn't persuaded Merle to stay on by offering half the profit out of the music business, he wouldn't have stayed, and there's no way I would have done the hard part of the dues-paying days without Merle's driving and help on the road and taking care of the business. Most people don't realize what it comes to. In 1967, Merle and I had just done the Today Show with Hugh Downs. We went to New York and done it real early in the morning. And Merle said, Dad, you know, I think I'll quit the music for a while and do something else. I believe I can get a job paying more money. I said, "I'm sure you could, son, but I don't see how I can make it without you. I'll tell you what, if you want to stay on, I'll give you half the profit." He thought about it a few minutes, and he said, "I don't believe I can beat that. I believe I'll stay with you."
Driving a bargain with his dad. But part of it was, you know, you talked about all the hard work and how difficult it is and how Merle helped him with that. But in the beginning, he just missed him an awful lot, didn't he? When even before Merle could play, wasn't that part of it? He'd go on the road and really miss Merle deeply.
He'd miss Merle and Nancy and Rosalie. And it was an incredibly hard life for a blind musician who had sort of music forced upon him as a profession, as a way he could support Rosalie and Nancy and Merle. I think being an electrician would have been much closer to his desired profession. And he's out riding the bus to New York City or to Philadelphia, hoping that his agent, first Ralph Rensler and then Manny Greenhill, had correctly gotten the information to the young person from the Student Folk Society or from the basket right. house where he was playing to pick him up at the right time and to know who he was and to get him where he was staying. It's a hard enough life for a fully sighted person, yeah. but for a blind person to be out by themselves riding the buses and playing in this day, you'd play several nights at one venue, but still, that was a rough life, eating hamburgers and sleeping on couches, is how Doc put it.
We'll find out more about that life and about Merle Fest and the life and legacy of Doc Watson when our conversation continues. Art Menias, former coordinator of Merle Fest, is with us. Bob Cantwell, professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Kent Gustafson, who wrote a biography about Doc. All of them and Danny Gotham, Jim Collier, and Joe Newberry to play some music on the state of things. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, celebrating the life and music of Doc Watson, North Carolina native, died last month at the age of 89, a guitar virtuoso and ambassador of traditional folk music.
Let it rain, let it pour, let it rain a whole lot more, Lord. I got them deep river blues. Let the rain drive right on, let the waves sweep along, Lord, I got them deep river blues.
Here's Doc Watson playing Deep River Blues. I'm joined in the studio today by Robert Cantwell, the Townsend Ludington Professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, author of the book When We Were Good, The Folk Revival. Kent Gustafson joins us from the studios of KWGS in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Kent is the author of the book Was Blind, But Now I See, a biography of music legend Doc Watson. And musicians Danny Gotham, Jim Collier, and Joe Newberry are all with us. We're talking with Art Menias, former coordinator of Merle Fest, now director of the Arts Center in Carrboro. Tell us how Merle Fest came about.
Well, and you know, Merle passed away in the tractor accident in October of 1985, and at the same time, there was an initiative within the then 57 campus community college system in North Carolina to make the campuses more attractive, less industrial looking. And as it so happened, a horticulturalist was on the faculty at Wilkes Community College in Wilkesboro named B. Towns. And he thought of the idea of creating the Eddie Merle Watson Memorial Garden of the Senses that would have Braille information on the plants and a special wall with engravings of musical instruments and of Doc and Merle. And there were people on the Endowment Corporation for Wilkes Community College who had entree to Doc, especially Bill Young, who was a career banker but a very serious guitarist as an amateur, and he would go to Deep Gap and pick with Doc when Doc was home off the road. So Bill Young took Bea up to meet Doc and Rosalie and to pitch the idea of having a big memorial concert, which would then fund the Eddie Merle Watson Garden. Well, Rosalie listened to them talk for a while and suggested that a concert was the wrong idea, that they should have an annual festival that would be a living memorial for Merle and would be a steady fundraiser for the college rather than a one-time make the garden in and out. So that's exactly what happened. And Doc promised that Ralph Rensler, who had created the Smithsonian's Festival on the Mall in D.C., would come and tell them what to do. Since, you know, my first engagement was a call from B-Town saying, I'm just a gardener and I have to put on a music festival. So they had no experience in doing this, but Doc kept saying, Ralph will come and tell you what to do. Well, Ralph was in France for an extended period. Ralph got there on the Wednesday night before the festival started on Friday. And at that point, they didn't even have a schedule for the acts. They had just decided to put on an outdoor stage as well as the 1,100-seat indoor John A. Walker Center. So it was all chaos and confusion that somehow worked beautifully there in late April of 1988 with a stunning array of artists all donating their time because they loved Doc and loved Merle and wanted to be part of this event. There were about 3,500 people who showed up in 1988.
That's the first one. And it's been going for 18 years. So apparently it was good enough to make everybody believe it could happen again and should.
Yeah, this was number 25 this April.
Wow, 25.
It reached the quarter century with Doc. He did exactly 25 Merle Watson Memorial or Merle Fest.
Merle Fest. Wow, it's an amazing tribute. Doc was also famous for his humility on stage. He could not quite push the spotlight away, but he wasn't flashy. And let me ask each of you, and I know, Jim, you spent time with him and you played with him. What was it like? Because he's bigger than life. People are always coming up just wanting to sort of spend a minute, you know, basking in the glow. That had to have some effect, and it didn't seem to.
Well, besides being intimidated to play with him, you know, he was very forgiving, and he seemed to be very, you know, he was very appreciative of any effort that you were making, you know, and he was eager to learn from what other people were doing. That was something. And he was not he didn't brag on himself. And he also, like I say, the thing that really comes out in his music is there's excellent playing. There's nothing for show. I mean, it's just from his heart. It's so sincere, and it's just what he could do. And, you know, some people may look at it and say, well, that's just showing off, but it's not. I mean, it wasn't. And it never came across that way to me.
And his stage presence, again, you say there's nothing particularly flashy about it, and yet it was a huge stage presence, famous for his storytelling as well. Let's listen to him on stage.
A couple of preachers, a Baptist and a Methodist, living at either end of a little community, and it was back in the days when people didn't have many cars. They rode bicycles to church, and one Sunday morning when the Methodist fella comes whistling along down the road on his bicycle, he meets that Baptist boy walking, and he asked him where his bike was, and he says, you know, I don't know where that thing's at. If somebody didn't steal it, he said, I've left it somewhere and forgot what I'd done with it. Well, he said, I'll tell you, the Methodist fellow says, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go down to the churches this morning and preach a good sermon on the Ten Commandments. And when we get down to where it says, thou shalt not steal, we'll dwell long and loud. And chances are that one of our sermons will pay off. So next Sunday morning, they come riding along down the road. He met the Baptist fellow. He had his bicycle. And he says, well, one of our sermons paid off, and the Baptist boy dropped his head. He says, yeah, mine did, but not like you think. He says, when I got down there to where it says, covet not thy neighbor's wife, I remembered where I left my bicycle.
Ken Gustafson, Doc's reputation is nearly saintly. He can do everything on stage, storytell. He carries the folk tradition with him. People are kneeling at his feet, and yet he's humble. How did he maintain his humility?
Well, I think it came from the very beginning. You know, Doc's career really didn't start with Ralph Rensler coming down from the north. It started being a hardworking, getting no pay local musician who was on stage playing, you know, 40-minute long tunes while people were dancing. And Doc always talked about he couldn't be the front man of a band in the 40s. because he wasn't flashy. Just like you were mentioning earlier, he wasn't flashy on stage, but all you have to do is close your eyes, and then he's flashy. Then he can do anything that anybody else can do. And when Rinsler came down, when Ralph Rinsler came down, he wasn't looking for, you know, a spangled shirt and a little dance and a joke. He wanted the down-home folksiness and incredible voice and ripping guitar picking that Doc Watson could do.
And a tradition bearer, more than just a musician and a performer, Bob. He's a guy who bears the folklore tradition. How would you describe his contribution as a folklorist?
Yeah. Well, as Ken mentioned, he's not only does he grow up with gospel songs and ballads in his family going back several generations, but from youth onwards, he is exposed to a wide variety of music on radio and record, which I think have to be thought of as part of the oral tradition, A-U-R-A-L, the ear tradition of mountain music and our traditional music generally. Moreover, Doc remembered everything he heard. He lived in a world of sound. I think it's really interesting listening to his Docability album that, you know, if you grew up in the 1950s, you realize that we were all hearing on the radio pretty much what Doc heard, the same variety of music, but Doc remembers it much better than the rest of us do.
That album is when he gets to go back to his electric guitar
right.
and play the stuff he was playing when he was, quote, discovered, right?
And also when he was playing with the country western band, he needed to learn tunes, and he listened to the radio and picked up on those tunes. But he was able, through his voice and his performance style, to really expand our sense of the great body of American music, because he, in a sense, channeled it through his playing and through his voice and his powerful musical imagination.
Well, I want to ask the musicians here, and I'll start with you, Danny. In a way, nobody dares imitate Doc Watson, right? But in another way, he sort of influenced everybody. If that's true, how do you hear his influence in music today?
Well, here's the way I look at it. The best thing I can do is to just play like myself, because that's what Doc did. He played like himself. What he was what he played and what he sang. And if I really want to be influenced by him, the best thing to do is not try to play like him or sing like him, but to play like myself, because that's probably the best lesson that I learned from Doc.
Yeah. So everybody's just nodding here. I don't know if you have anything to add, Joe, but
it's funny. Everybody's got to take their stab at trying to sound like your heroes, and then hopefully you branch off and sound like yourself. But I mean, one of the things when Doc is a real entry port, Danny mentioned living in upstate New York, Doc is very accessible. His music is very accessible. And so the big entry port for me was the Circle album in 1971. And so the cool thing about that album, it was not just the music, but it was these guys talking to each other. And you get to hear Doc meet Merle Travis for the first time. And, you know, like we just did a Circle album tribute a couple of months ago, and we all know all of that record. Like, you know, Doc, the first time you hear him on, he goes, hello, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
That was big in the 70s, by the outtake on the,
oh,
on the
yeah.
album.
Yeah.
In that conversation, Doc compliments Merle and saying how much he loved his picking and loved that coal mining album. And Merle says, look who's talking.
Yeah. Look, well, the other thing is Doc, you know, he was well known in some circles, but Roy Acuff kept calling him Doc Watkins.
Take it, Doc Watkins. Yeah, I've heard about you, but I haven't exactly heard you on the radio. Well, we talked about and Jim, because you were actually somebody who played with him, and so I wonder if
I want to make sure you understand. I played with him on occasion, but I had a very close relationship with his mom and his older brother Arnold and their family. So I came to Doc in the old traditional music that he performed when he first got started. So that was really my entry level for it. And I found in that this honesty and purity that just has been with me ever since I played. And I started as hard as I could when I was in high school to try to just get a hold of something like that.
We've been talking about him long enough. We should hear another sample of his music. Early in his career, Doc recorded a medley of traditional songs known as Texas Gales and Blackberry Rag. Let's listen. Thank you. And I know, Jim Collier, that song was pretty important to you. Is that the first version of that song you heard?
That's the first song I ever learned on the mandolin, and I didn't even own the mandolin. A friend of mine had loaned me this impossible to play old mandolin that he had, and I set about trying to, you know, it was in my head, and the C chord was very natural, so I just sort of picked it out, and I said, wow. And so I played that song since, 1969.
I'd like to ask all of you to play a song that when you think about Doc Watson and his influence on you, is the song that really comes to mind, and I'd like you to play the 2.5-minute version of it. If you don't mind. What is the song? What are you going to play? You play Trouble?
Yeah.
Great. I'm Trouble. On a tribute to Doc Watson today on The State of Things. I want to thank all of my guests for being with me. You've been listening to Danny Gotham on the guitar, Joe Newberry and Jim Collier, members of the band Big Medicine. You can find them online at bigmedicine.com. Danny Gotham, guitar teacher and director of Pick and Bow Music, Pick and Bow Music Weekend at the Murphy School in July. For more information about that, sharedvisions.org. Also want to thank Robert Cantwell, who is the Townsend Ludington Professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. He's written a book called We Were Good, The Folk Revival. Kent Gustafson, want to thank you as well. Wrote a biography of Doc called Was Blind, Now I See. And that is the state of things for today. Gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for being. Also, Art Minius, who is a former coordinator of Merlefest, now director of the Art Center in Carborough. Thank all of you for being on the program
today.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia. We leave you now with one more from Doc Watson, I Am a Pilgrim.
My sister and her brother, they've done gone on to that other shore. And I'm determined to go and see forevermore. When I go down to the river of Jordan, just to bathe my weary soul, if I can but touch the hem of his garment, good Lord, then I believe he'll make me whole. I am a pilgrim and a stranger traveling through this worrisome land. I've got a home built and at yonder city, good Lord, and it's not made by hand.